The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We are chapter 2. Let's start at the beginning. We'll go quickly over what we did, and then we'll move on. So it says, V'yelech ish mi beit Levi. And a man went from the house of Levi. V'yikach et bat Levi. And he took the daughter of Levi. So he had a number of issues here. First of all, what does it mean to go when there are absolutely no geographical points of reference being made? If he says, and he went from here to there, so then the word went means something. But if it doesn't give me some kind of physical, geographical point of reference, then what does went mean? So the oral tradition tells us that he went in accordance to the counsel of his daughter, and that this is not to be understood as a physical going, but actually a kind of figurative going. Like, he went ahead with it, he went with it, right? I'm going to go with it, rather than, you know, you're going to go along with it. Doesn't literally mean physically, but he went with it, meaning, and what is that referring to? So it refers to the fact that Amram was the Gadol Ador. Amram was the prime leading Torah figure model of the generation. He saw the suffering of the generation, right? Incredible suffering of the generation. So he got up and divorced his wife, which itself gave license to everyone else to get up and divorce their wives, alright, because they simply just couldn't have children. For what purpose? Give birth to a child in the concentration camp of Egypt? What for? Just to see them die? What for? Alright. His daughter, however, tells him, as we learned yesterday, that how can you do this? Your decree is even more stringent than Pharaoh's decree. Your decree includes both the girls and the boys. He's only decreed against the boys. Alright, but maybe the women will have girls also. His decree is only in this world. Your decree is in this world and the next world. Okay? His decree, maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't happen. But yours, being a tzaddik, will certainly happen. And so he, with tremendous humbleness, acknowledges his mistake, right, and gets up and makes a public issue and actively, publicly, v'yikach et bat Levi. He takes the bat Levi. Alright? And so what we see here is a person who has no name. The name is not important, apparently, over here, who this person is. This person is demonstrating a tremendous Kiddush Hashem, a sanctification of God's name, by publicly getting up and bewedding his wife, was demonstrating to the Egyptians that we still have faith, and we go on. Alright? Verse 2. V'tahari isha v'telet. And the woman conceived, and she gave birth. Alright? The oral tradition says that the facts are that she was actually already pregnant before they were remarried. Alright? 3 months before this whole story happened, she was already pregnant. So if that's in fact the case, then the verse is very misleading. Okay? Because the verse seems to imply that right now she conceived, and right now, and then she gave birth. So what does it mean? Why does it say here that she conceived, when in fact it's not here that she conceived? So the oral tradition says this is to hint to us that her birth was as simple and painless as her conception. Telling us that she was a righteous woman. And the principle is that righteous women were not included in the curse of Eve. When Eve was cursed that in pain you shall give birth, that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody has to experience that. Okay? Some could transcend that by virtue of their righteousness. And therefore we're talking not about just any old person, we're talking about a person who is very righteous. Okay? As well as we pointed out that the oral tradition said that she had this mysterious, miraculous restoration of youth. Right? All of a sudden she's young. So it's clear that the oral tradition is adding a kind of a miraculous dimension to the story. Okay? People who are in the thick of pain and suffering transcend the moment, transcend themselves, and with a tremendous commitment to the Jewish people and to God, remarry as an act of Kiddush Hashem, as an act of faith, as a demonstration of true faith and trust. And it's that kind of people, that type of person who is worthy to facilitate the bringing of the Mashiach into the world, the Mashiach of that time, who is Moses, the Savior. Alright? So she gives birth to a son. Vitere oto. She saw him. Ki tov hu. That he is good. Now this too, we remarked the other day, is a little strange. Because it should have simply said, first of all, what does it mean she saw he was good? How do you see that a baby's good? He was behaving well? Doesn't make any sense. And what does it have to do with the fact that it says that she hid him for 3 months? What, and if he cried too much, she wouldn't hide him to protect him? Right? So we have a definite problem in understanding what the verse means, that she hid him, that she saw that he was good. So the simple meaning we offered yesterday was that it means that she saw that he was healthy. Because he was a premature baby. He was born after 6 months. Alright? And therefore he was a high risk, you know, in terms of high risk danger. Alright? So she saw that he was good, meaning that she saw that he was healthy. The problem with that interpretation is, if the word good only means that, then it should have said that. Which is, she saw that he was healthy. Right? So therefore there must be other allusions to what it means that she saw that he was good. So we read the other day, the Talmud that says, that she saw that he was good means that she saw that his name was good. Okay? And therefore, how do we read the verse? If you look at the verse carefully, look at the Hebrew with me. It says, V'tahar ha'isha v'teled. And the woman conceived and gave birth to a son. Vitere oto. She saw him. Ki tov hu. That he is good. Now what it should have said is, she saw that he was good. But not that she saw him, that he was good. You follow? That extra hu. Ki tov hu. That hu is superfluous. It's extra. It has no meaning. Okay? So the Midrash gives it meaning. She saw him that he was good. Meaning that that was his name. You follow? She saw him that he was Mr. Good. Alright? And that's how the Midrash reads this. That's what she saw. She saw that that would be his name. But another opinion is not satisfied or wants to add another quality to it. She saw that he was good. Rabbi Yehuda says his name was Tuvia. Not that his name was Tov, but his name was Tuvia. What does Tuvia literally mean? The goodness of God. Now where did the rabbis get that from the verse? Because this rabbi sees the who alluding to God, not to the baby. She saw him that he was good. Who's the he? God was good, and therefore, therefore his real name was Tuvia, the good of God. But none of these are the simple meaning of the verse. Okay? Now I want to explain something methodologically which is essential in studying Torah. There are 4 levels of interpretation of the Torah. All valuable, all valid, and all essential. There's something called pshat. Pshat means simple. So pshat is the simple meaning. Then there was what's called drash, which is a more flowery explanation. Then you have something called remez, which means hint. And then you have something called sod, which means secret. Okay? You can remember it by the word pardes. If you put the resh and the dalet here, you've got pardes. Right? Pardes. Now, pshat is understanding the verse in its most simplest way, following the criteria of its syntax and its context. Syntax meaning the inner structure of the verse, okay? And context means how the verse relates to the verse before, the verse after, the paragraph, the whole thing. Now, you have various different kinds of commentaries. Okay, now, that's simple. Pshat is the simple meaning of the verse that abides by its literal structure. Drash is another understanding of verse, but an understanding which does not honor, or does not feel confined by, let's put it that way, because it does honor, but it's not confined by the literal structure of the verse. Here is an example of that. Okay? That she saw that he was good, meaning suggesting that the word he is referring to God, would not be a simple understanding of the verse. Since God's name is not mentioned anywhere in this verse, for the word he to all of a sudden suggest God would not be literal. Okay? But it would be something that's implicit in it, suggested here. Alright? That would be a drash. Or it might be a remez. Remez are generally a little bit more little hints. Perhaps, sometimes in the Torah you see a big letter all of a sudden. Like in the Shema, the Shin is written large. Alright? The Dalet is written large. Or in the word Vayikra in the beginning of the book of Leviticus, the last Aleph is small. It's a hint to something. And we need an oral tradition that tells what it's hinting to. And then you have something called So, which is Kabbalah. Alright? Now, amongst the commentators, they take different approaches to the text. So Rashi, who was one of the most famous commentators, okay, Rashi, Reish Shin Yud, he looks in the Midrash, the oral tradition, and he selects an opinion which best serves the criteria of Pshat. Rashi never says anything of his own. So you just know that. So when you're studying the Chumash and you're starting to get to know some commentators, so you should know that Rashi never says anything of his own. And what he does is he looks in the oral tradition, just as we are right now, and then he selects a position, or he selects the position which he sees as the best Pshat. That doesn't mean that he doesn't honor the other positions. But he sees the other positions are a different form of interpretation, which is valid. Okay? But first the person needs to know the simple meaning before they can go on and start getting flowery and getting the secrets. The person has to get at least the first simple meaning of the verse. Ramban Nachmanides, who's another commentary that you will hear me refer to. Okay? His attitude is, the Kabbalah is his interpretation. In other words, when he studies the Torah, the primary interest of him is, what does the Kabbalah say about this verse? How is this verse understood from the position of the secrets of Torah? And when you read the Ramban, you'll see that he will say, and in truth, whenever he says, and in truth, he's saying, this is the Kabbalistic position, interpretation of this verse. There's another commentary by the name of the Ibn Ezra. Alright? His approach is, whatever interpretation I can see, which follows the dictates of its literal form, is a valid interpretation. In other words, the Ibn Ezra has not established his purpose to go looking in the oral tradition and finding an oral tradition that gives the best understanding. That's not what that is not what his soul has moved him to do in his work. But what his soul moved him to do was to offer an understanding of the Torah based on the grammatical and literary style of the Torah. And he would give an interpretation that may in fact not be found anywhere. But that too is valid to do. Alright? But it's very important that all the commentators are considered to be valid and important, but do have different perspectives and have accepted upon them different missions, different purposes in their commentary. Rashi's purpose is pshat. Ramban's purpose is more towards so, secret. Ibn Ezra's purpose is pshat, but pshat which is not confined to just what the oral tradition says about the verse. And you have another commentary by the name of Sepharno. Sepharno is a little bit more interested in somewhat of the more philosophical questions that arise from the text. Right? And then you've got all the Hasidish commentaries, and it goes on and on and on and on. So it's really important to kind of know where you're at in terms of the various commentaries. What we're doing right now as a methodological first step, first we're becoming sensitive to the text itself. Because the commentators are aids to understanding the text. But if we're not even sensitive to the text, then we will be certainly not properly bringing in the commentaries. Okay? Utilizing the commentary. So here's an example of such an experience, you know, such a fact. It says that she saw that he was good, and we're trying to figure out what did she see, what does that mean, what does that have to do with her hiding him? Alright? And if she didn't see he was good, she wouldn't hide him? Alright? Well, if it means that she saw he was healthy, then yes, she would hide him. If she saw that he was about to die any second, then of course she wouldn't hide him. What's the point? Right? But of course, if that's all she saw, then it wouldn't have said Tov. It would have said Bari. She saw that he was healthy. She saw that he was strong. So obviously Tov must be suggesting something else. So the oral tradition says that was his name. Another oral tradition says, well, no, his name was Tuvia. Another oral tradition says that she saw that he was suited for prophecy. She saw something about him that meant that she saw that he had the qualities it took to be, and how she saw this was an insight. She didn't see something physical. She had a certain, she saw, you know, it's more figuratively translated. Another opinion, she saw that he was born circumcised. Now that makes a little more sense in terms of it being a physical seeing, and that she saw something unique about the child. Alright? But another commentary said, another opinion is that she saw. What did she see? The sages say the entire house became full of light when he was born. Now it's interesting, just as what I was demonstrating to you before, Rashi, on his commentary, he brings this opinion down and does not bring any of the other ones. Why would he do that? Why would Rashi quote only this opinion and not the other opinions? We just said why. Because Rashi's only interested in pshat. He's only interested in that interpretation which is on the level of the simplest, best literal interpretation. Now, how is this the best literal interpretation? Seems like the most mystical one. So, Rashi is saying that the house was filled with light makes the most sense out of this verse literally, even though there's nowhere in this verse that suggests anything about light. It doesn't say anything about life. But the oral tradition that says that this is a fact. The fact is that her house became full of light. Mysterious light. Alright? And knowing that factor gives this verse the best literal meaning. Why? Because it qualifies for understanding what it means she saw. You know, seeing doesn't have to be figurative, but she literally saw something. She saw this light. And she saw that he was good. And we find that in the beginning of Genesis, it says that God looked at the light and it was good. Alright? And therefore we see that seeing light can be seen as something good. And therefore that information will enable us to understand, give us the best literal meaning of this verse. Alright? Now remember, there's also Midrash that says that she saw that he was circumcised. Now that would have satisfied the word seeing. So why doesn't Rashi bring that down as giving us the best, or allowing us to discover the best literal meaning? Why? Because nowhere in the Torah does it say to see something circumcised is good. Do you follow this? So that's just a sample of how Rashi works. Yes?
Are you saying that the Kabbalah says there's light in the
what we're doing here is we're trying to understand Rashi as a commentator, because you'll hear me say Rashi in the future, God willing, you continue to learn Torah, and you'll need to know the different approaches of the different commentators. Okay? So you don't expect something from a commentator what he's not supplying you with. Rashi is not supplying you with fancy ideas. Right? Rashi says at the beginning of his own, near the beginning, that I've only come to give you pshat. Meaning all I'm interested in is giving you the best literal translation as I can find in the oral tradition. The Ibn Ezra will say, I want to give you the best literal translation and I don't care where I get it from. If I get it from myself, that's my approach. And that's a valid approach. Rashi has not accepted that as his approach. Not that he doesn't find that acceptable, it's just that wasn't the purpose of his commentary. So he looks in the oral tradition to see if he can find some kind of information or statement that would give this verse the best meaning that would follow the literal demands. Alright? And so he looks in here and he sees that the one that he believes satisfies the best literal meaning is that there was light, and that's what she saw, that it was good. My question was, why did they select the one about the circumcision? Because that would satisfy the literal meaning of the word to see, but it wouldn't satisfy the literal word of to good. Because there's nowhere in the Torah that it says to see someone circumcised is good. But it is in the Torah to see light is good. And that's why Rashi did that. Right? So you just had a taste. No big philosophical things here. Now we could then become creative and go somewhat beyond Rashi, through Rashi, which is, I wonder what that really means. You know, what does that conceptually, philosophically mean to us? You know, it's very nice to say, a midrash says, well, the house was full of light, and she saw that. Good. But what does that tell me? It tells me, number one, that something very mystical and metaphysical and miraculous is happening about this baby. From his very inception. Alright? From his very birth already, he was born to be a prophet. He was born to bring the light of God in the world. Alright? And that's already giving me a bit of a new dimension on who Moshe is. Alright? It's also giving me a certain opportunity to make a parallel over here. Because what this is really all about is the creation of the Jewish people, which in a certain parallel way mirrors the creation of the world. Just as the world started off with a darkness, right? And then there came a light which God saw it was good. So there's a hint over here, I think a very clear hint through the parallel, that what we're talking about is a whole new level in the creative process of God. Alright? This is not just like the story of some people. But this is an added dimension in creation, whereby this human being, Moses, is the conduit for a light in a darkness of exile. And there's a new dimension, a new chapter to the meaning of creation. And then we can think about that and what it implies for us too in terms of philosophical sense. But Rashi is not saying that. Rashi just tells you this and then left to your own, you know, faculties to figure out what might that teach us, what might that feel for us or mean for us. Alright. So it says that she saw it was good. And she hides it for 3 months. Alright, and that's basically where we got to. And we also pointed out another fascinating idea here. Is the oral tradition says, what did she see? That he was circumcised. And that gives us an added understanding of Moses. Because who's supposed to circumcise you? Your father. If Moses is born already circumcised, then who essentially is his father? God. God. And therefore what we see over here are, at first glance, some very disturbing parallels between Moshe Rabbeinu and JC. Okay? That shouldn't disturb you at all. Because it makes very much sense that when Paul was modeling Jesus into the Messiah, right, he simply modeled him as best as possible to reflect what Judaism kind of saw of the Messiah. Alright? So it's very possible. I mean, it's a theory that I'm presenting here. But Jesus wasn't a Christian, as if you went to the class on the B'nai Noach movement from the leaders of the B'nai Noach movement, then you'll see that Christianity comes much later. Jesus wasn't a Christian. I don't think Jesus would have felt comfortable in a church. You know? In fact, he probably would have walked down and said, this is idolatry. right, and kick me off your wall, you know. But that's probably what he would have said.
He would have torn the thing off and broke it.
Right, because it was idolatry. So, but it's interesting over here that we aren't talking not about some person called Moses, and that only kind of adds to that the no names over here. We're not talking about Yocheved and Amram who gave birth to Moses. We're talking about two people who really don't have, or whose individual identity is not important, but in fact their ability to transcend their individual predicament and remarry for the sake of God, for the sake of the Jewish people, is, and identify so much with God's purpose in the world, is what made them into the kind of people that so identified with the divine, they so made God a partner in their life, that this child, all children have three partners that created them, mother, father, and God. But this child is even more the expression, the partner quality of God in this partnership has become even more manifest in this child by merit of the sacredness of the two parents and their relationship being for the sake of God, for the sake of the Jewish people, for the sake of history, right? As a demonstration of faith in God. And therefore the share, so to speak, you know, in this corporation, in this enterprise called you, okay, depending on how much your parents allow God to have a share in your creation, which He has anyways, but they might not acknowledge it, and if they acknowledge it, they might not really actively make that part of their lives, all right? And their motivation for having a child is, oh, I want a kid, you know, because my friend has a kid, or I want a kid to, like, name after me, or I want a kid to give over my business. Who knows, right, what motivations people sometimes have. But if a person's motivation is to do the mitzvah of pru or vu, which is clearly their motivation, all right? Their motivation. Because there's no other reason to do it. There's no other reason to do it because they think that the kids are going to be dead anyways, right? In a matter of moments. They'll be soon caught. And so these are people who are performing the mitzvah for no other reason to perform the mitzvah, with no expectations of this child living. And therefore, they so identify with the divine will, right, that this name, this included God so much in the process that they transcended themselves and facilitated the birth of such a huge neshama, such a huge soul. Moses' soul includes all the souls of the Jewish people. Right? Because his father was the leader of the Jewish people, and everything he did was out of love and concern for the Jewish people. And his father felt the pain of the Jewish people. And that's really, you know, just so remarkable. And so we're talking about the Son of God, the child of God. Each and every one of us is the child of God. But the amount that is manifest in us, and the extent that the roles that we are born in this world to play express that in an even more direct way, is so much dependent upon the intentions of our parents. And that's why when one is having relations, the sanctity of their intentions, we are told, definitely influences the kind of soul they bring into the world. Okay? The kind of divine spark they bring into the world. Alright. Now, listen to this. So she hides them for 3 months. Hides them for 3 months. Verse 3. V'lo yachla od hitzbina. And she wasn't able to hide them anymore. What question would you ask at this point?
Why?
Well, why not? What do you mean she wasn't able? I mean, it could be a number of reasons she wasn't able because she was scared that they would catch her and kill her. Do you think that's what it means? I mean, we got to figure out, what does that mean? I highly doubt that also that's what it means. So we now look at our Talmud. It does make a comment about this. The top of 8. And she hid him for 3 months. For the Egyptians did not start counting days of pregnancy until the time that Amram took her back. But she had already conceived 3 months before that. Alright? In other words, now whether they knew or she knew that she was pregnant or not, I don't know. Okay? But But what happened was the Egyptians were keeping close records on when people are getting, you know, showing signs of pregnancy, so that they could figure out when someone's going to be born and just like go in there and kill the baby. All right. So, but in this case, they made a mistake, because when the husband got up and divorced his wife, they probably assumed that she couldn't have been pregnant. Because if she was pregnant, what's the point of divorcing her, when the whole point of getting divorced was not to have children? So they immediately assumed that she's not pregnant. When he remarried her, they began to count from the day of that remarriage, assuming that quite likely there'll be a baby 9 months after this marriage. What happened though, however, was the baby was born, right, premature, which means 3 months later after the marriage, she gave birth, and now she could hide him for another 3 months, okay, because she had another 3 months until 9 months was up when they thought the baby would have been born, all right? And so what happens is she couldn't hide him anymore. That's why she couldn't hide him anymore. Now we understand the verse. Without this verse, what do you mean, why can't she hide him anymore? I don't understand this verse. It means nothing to me. I don't know what this verse is saying. Rashi also brings this oral tradition down. Why? Because without it, this verse doesn't mean anything to me. She wasn't able. I don't understand. What do you mean by that? What's that supposed to mean, she wasn't able? Without Rashi bringing this verse down, we'd be at the mercy of our own imagination. Okay? So there's an example, once again, how an oral tradition is essential for the simple meaning of these verses. And without it, the verse doesn't mean anything. You know? You could come up with all kinds of crazy interpretations and make Miriam Yocheved into some horrible person. You know? Or not horrible, but, you know, not of the stature she really deserves to be seen as. There's another thing that the oral tradition says, and this is from the Talmud. She could not hide him anymore. Why not? Let her continue hiding him. I mean, why not? I mean, maybe they'll find him, maybe they won't. All right? She could not do so, for when the Egyptians heard that a child had been born, they brought another child there so that the hidden child would hear his cries and they would cry together, as it is written, song and song, song of songs. We have been taken by the foxes, the little foxes. Now, what is this oral tradition accomplishing for us? What is it explaining for us? Also, but why is it saying this on this verse? I mean, how does it help us understand the verse better? That's what you always want to ask yourself when you're studying Torah. Whenever you read an oral tradition or a commentary, you want to say, how does this affect my understanding of this verse? How does this add or enhance my understanding of this verse? Well, when I read the verse, it says she couldn't hide him anymore. So they said, well, why? Why couldn't she hide him anymore? Well, what has changed now? What is new today that wasn't yesterday or the day before? So what's new is the chances of them coming are very excellent, because they've been counting and keeping, you know, a certain record of when should a baby be born. But then we're not satisfied with that either, because you should still hide him. Because what choice do you have? I mean, you know, maybe they'll walk in and they'll look in the closet and, you know, look at the fridge. I don't know. And see that you don't have a baby. All right? Maybe they won't find him. So all this tradition is telling us, no, they would for sure find him in the house. Why? Because these Egyptians would walk around with these little Egyptian babies, walk into a person's house, pinch the baby, cause him to cry, and the Jewish baby would start to cry too. All right? It's a midrash. All right? That's what this oral tradition, that's what this Talmud is saying, but a little bit more of the details are found in other midrashim. Right? And this shows you that the Jewish baby's natural inclination is to feel the pain of others. Right? There's a basic Jewish attribute. Doesn't mean that others can't have it. But it's a very common genetic, spiritual genetic inheritance to Jewish people, which is they feel the pain of the world. All right? They feel the pain of the world. In fact, this is brought in the Zohar too. A non-Jewish fellow comes up to a rabbi and says, you know, I don't understand what's so chosen about you people. You know, you people are the smallest people in the world, the most fragile people in the world. You know, and you people have suffered the most in the world. So what's so chosen about you? As well as you have such, you know, exact, rigid laws of diet and everything. He says, my people, we eat anything, we do everything, and we're strong and we're big and whatever. And we haven't anywhere come close to the suffering you've suffered. So the rabbi answered like this. We see the whole world as one body. One being. And every nation correlates to a different limb or inner organ of that body. Right? And some nations are the stomach, and some nations will be the lungs, you know, the Jewish people are the heart of the body. Right? They're the heart of the body. And you know the heart is a very small muscle, a very fragile muscle, and as you know, that if anything goes wrong anywhere in the body, the heart feels it also. The heart feels it also. It has immediately impact for the heart too. So even if the finger gets hurt, somehow the heart connects to that also, as an impacted by that. So it's over here, the Midrash is saying that this is a very natural quality that Jewish people do inherit. I'm not saying that people who are not Jewish wouldn't inherit it. I'm just saying that, but this is a quality certainly that Jewish people should have. Okay? And once again, doesn't mean that they'll develop it either. One might be born with a certain potential, and as a baby they cried for people's pains, but as they grew older they learned how to forget about that. So, anyways, so that's what it means that she couldn't hide him anymore. She couldn't hide him anymore. There's just no way. They were going to come and they would certainly find him. So what does she do? Verse 3. V'tikach lo tevat gomeh. So she took for him a basket of reeds. Right? And as you learned, she put pitch on it and clay. And she put the baby into a swamp. And we'll get to it in a second. So now what's a little bit strange about these words? V'tikach lo tevat gomeh. She took for him a basket of reeds. So there should be a couple of questions you would ask yourself about just these three words. That's what's in English? No, but that's not what it says. It says she took for him. I mean, she went out and got for him a basket of reeds. And then she put on this basket, you know, pitch and clay. She put the baby in the basket. And then she put the basket with the baby in the river.
And that's why it's not so much that what's made and intentionated.
Yes, this is something very... These are details that are, you know, like, once again, unless there's a reason, you know, you say, well, why was it made out of this? So I could say, well, why not? You know what I mean? It's got to be made out of something. But rather, our question is, why is the Torah being so specific of what it's being made out of? When these are details that generally the Torah does not offer us. Alright? So therefore, it must have some kind of meaning. It must be saying something about the story. Because the Torah doesn't give us details that are unimportant or that just have no meaning. Alright? And that's a good question. And therefore, we can expect to try and find some answer to that. We also would ask ourselves what? Did you want to give an answer?
Yeah.
Well, wait for it. Well, let's get some more questions. Also, as I've mentioned to you methodologically, when you study Torah, you want to kind of ask yourself, are there better words that I could have used if I were writing this? If I were God and I wrote the Torah? Would I have written it in a more efficient way? What? I think it would have simply said, she put him in a basket. Why do I care where she got a basket from? You know what I mean? Could have simply say, and so the mother put him in a basket, and put him in the river. You know, I think that would be sufficient. But to say that she took for him a basket of reeds must be saying more than what I think is here. So I read it very carefully. And I begin to do some research on what might this in fact be adding to the story. So we look in the oral tradition. And it says, a basket of reeds. Why reeds? By the way, whatever you see in this English, which is in brackets, is the English translator's comments. It's not in the original, so you shouldn't make a mistake. Y reads, Rabbi Elazar said, from here it is derived that the righteous value their money more than their lives. Now the translator adds into it, or in this case, more than lives of their children. But that's the translator, and I'm not sure I would completely agree with this translator. All right?
The righteous value their money more than their lives?
Exactly. That's what this midrash is saying. Okay? We have two problems when we read this midrash. One problem is obviously the first one, which is, what are you talking about? What's so righteous about a person who values their money more than their lives? Gee, I thought that was really disgusting. I've met lots of people like that that value their money more than their lives, and it's a behavior which is disgusting, right? It is quite the opposite of being righteous. And yet the Torah says, the oral tradition says, that the righteous value their money more than their lives. All right? Now I want you to know that this is not the only place that it says this statement. This statement is repeated in numerous places in the Torah. It's a principle of a righteous person. We also find this statement by the story of Jacob. You might be aware of the fact, Jacob was moving with his whole entourage, and they were encamped, and he was preparing to meet with Esav, who for so many years hated him and was out to kill him. Right? They're camped in a certain place, and it says that they started to travel. And they crossed over the river Yabok, and then all of a sudden, Jacob realizes, oh my gosh, we forgot the little pots. The little pots. And so Jacob personally goes back to pick up the pots. Now, you know, that's a little strange. To go pick up pots. Now, they're not very expensive pots. You're already traveling. You've already gone over the river. So, like, forget about it. Or send somebody else after it. Forget about these pots. They're like little pots. Big deal. Some plastic containers. Now, the oral tradition says, because the righteous love their money. And that's a strange comment. That's question number one. Question number two is, if we could figure out what this strange comment means, why is this strange comment being made here? Okay, what does that have to do with the story of Moses and the fact that she took this basket? These are the questions that we would have to ask ourselves.